Hello, what is up? Good day, how's it going? I'm your host, Clay Skipper, and you are listening to Farewell. Today we are talking about eating, something we all do on a daily basis. Diet obviously has a huge impact on how we feel. If you are an athlete or a performer of some sort, it affects how well you show up for your performance or competition. It is a huge part of our day and our life. And yet, so many of us have a complicated relationship with it because we have grown up in diet culture and learning about fad diets and trend diets. And it has really warped our sense of knowing how to eat. And that is why I'm glad to be talking to Dr. Evelyn Triboli today. Dr. Triboli is a registered dietitian and nutritionist, and she is one of the co-founders of Intuitive Eating. Intuitive Eating, maybe you've heard of it before, is a eating framework that is about healing your relationship with food and making peace with all foods, so no foods are off limits, and honoring what your body wants and its hunger by eating when you're hungry and stopping when you're full. Now, if you're familiar with the growth equation, you've read Steve and Brad, you've listened to this podcast before, you know that we are strictly anti-diet. And we are not here to evangelize for intuitive eating. What I will say about intuitive eating is that it is much more a eating practice than a diet. And you know that we love our practices at the Growth Equation. As Dr. Triboli describes it, she says it is a mind-body framework rooted in self-compassion, and it is about rebuilding your trust in your body. And it's that part that intrigues me, that trust in your body, because I think a lot of us have lost trust in our body and have lost touch with our body's intuition. It's hard to know what we want, when we want it, and how much of it we want because we've been listening for so long about what we should want and what is quote-unquote good and what is quote-unquote bad. Even if I don't agree with everything in intuitive eating, I think it has many principles about listening to your body and being present in your body and being aware of what's happening in your body and honoring your hunger and giving your body what it wants and eating until it's satisfied. These sort of tenets and ideas that I think could repair our broken relationship with food and allow us to eat in a way that is much more sustainable and mindful and about satisfaction and satiation and not eating out of sheer habit or how we've been told to eat. But I think that as we try to find our way out of diet culture, these are the type of conversations we should be having. So here's my chat with Dr. Evelyn Triboli. I want to start with track, actually, because you ran track in college, right? And then didn't you compete in the 1984 Olympic trials for the marathon?
Yeah. In fact, I'll take you back even further. I competed on the boys track team in high school because there was not a girls team. So I ran in boys clothing and boys shoes because they didn't make girls clothing or shoes back then. And I will never forget my first girls running shoes that were made for girls. It felt like I was running on marshmallows. It was like one of my happiest days of life back in high school. and beating the boys. I love beating the boys as well. But yeah, I competed in college in track and cross country. And then when they finally let women run the marathon distance in 1984, they held a tryout and I met the qualifying standard to compete with those other. I didn't make the team. I knew that the trials itself would be my version of the Olympics. In fact, I was running with somebody I just met up with there and I'm waving to all, there's so many people and I'm waving and she goes like, what are you like a politician? And I said, no, I go, this is as far as I'm going to get and I'm going to enjoy all of it.
That's wonderful.
I didn't have a negative mindset. It's just that my best time compared to the American record was such a big difference. It'd have to be like an act of God for me to make the top three, you know? So it was a great experience. And that mindset still lives with me today, which is really fascinating to me. It's profound. I have a tenacity that's still there, mental. Sometimes I forget my body is not in the same place it was, you know, that long ago.
Do you have like lessons from those days that you're still using?
Yeah. You know what? I had mentioned to you offline that I recently have taken up surfing. And so the lesson I have from running, especially distance, is this tenacity. You just keep training and eventually you're going to improve. And I really needed that mindset with surfing because it didn't really work that way. You keep going out in the waves and you get smacked down, or at least I did. But eventually I started improving. I kept with it because I knew I would. And then once you get that first wave and that thrill, whoo, man, I was never looking back. It's like, where are the waves? I surf every opportunity I get.
So to get into
your other expertise outside of surfing, intuitive eating. I think a lot of people hear intuitive eating and have thoughts, connotations about it. A lot of people think of it as a diet, which is, it's very much not a diet. And we at the Growth Equation are pretty strictly anti-diet. And that's one of the reasons, like, especially fad diets, trend diets, it's pretty clear they don't work. Most people are selling snake oil. And so the reason I want to talk to you is your thing is really a practice, and we love like an eating practice, and we love practices because it's not necessarily a strict, like a set of strict rules so much as it is about having awareness of your body and its signals at a time when so much is disconnecting us from our body and what it's telling us. So I just wanted to like set the table stakes, but do you feel like that's a fair characterization?
I think it's an excellent characterization. And, you know, the fact that it is a form of self-connection, and the challenge I see with a lot of people that I work with is because they have been on the dieting roller coaster. Every time you eat according to someone else's plan, some influencer, you do so at your own peril in terms of disrupting your trust, the self-trust that happens. And so sometimes when people don't have the trust, it feels like a leap of faith to start listening to their body.
And yeah, so let's go through and talk about what is intuitive eating, and then maybe it'll be implicit in there what's not intuitive eating. But I think it's just, it'll be important to, for people to hear that from you, because there are a lot of myths, I think, around what intuitive eating is.
You know, there are. And I actually want to start there for just a little bit. I think it's really understandable that it's confusing. I recently did a little look up on TikTok. TikTok alone, there's over 2 billion hashtags on intuitive eating. So anytime on social media, there's like good news and bad news, like, yay, we are on the map. But then it's subject to everyone else's interpretation. So that adds to the confusion. So if anyone is confused out there, it's really okay. And, you know, we can say that intuitive eating is a mind-body framework rooted in, you know, self-compassion and listening to the innate wisdom of your body. And basically, it's you being in charge of your body. One of our biggest tenets that has confusion around is making peace with food, and that is all foods can fit. And people who don't understand intuitive eating will say, oh my gosh, if you let people eat whatever they want, it's going to be a big old mess. And research shows otherwise, that actually the quality of someone's eating either improves or stays the same. In other words, it doesn't go haywire. So it's just really exciting. I can always get into the weeds on the research, but I think what's really important to know is you get to be the boss of you. And you mentioned, you know, running, and just about every runner I've ever met has at some point have had an injury. And the reason I'm bringing this up is once you have an injury, that's a powerful learning experience. And so I will ask runners, you know, do you feel now when an emerging injury comes on, they go, oh yeah. Well, I'll say that same mindset and that same tool is what we use with intuitive eating. It's a connection to your body. And when you're listening to it and you have awareness, you get to learn a lot about yourself. And then the key is being able to respond in a timely manner in doing so.
So I think the first thing, and I know you fielded this question before, but I know some listeners who maybe have not heard from you or just learning about intuitive eating today will probably be asking this question. So I want to just anticipate that, which is, okay, if I start intuitively eating, which is there's all foods fit, so nothing is off limits. There's no moralizing food. There's no salad is
good.
And meat is medium and sugar is bad. Some people will say, okay, well, I'm just going to eat a pint of ice cream every day. That's sort of the usual. And it's a bit of a bastardization. It's like an easy, cheap, it's sort of a cheap shot, but it's one that I think people have. So how do you respond to that?
Glad you asked that, because I get that. I get a version of that so often, and I loved how you responded to it in terms of a bastardization. But here's what I would say: it's usually a reflection of the length of deprivation someone has had that they can't imagine that they would get tired of eating a pint of ice cream every single day. And so there's this phenomenon that happens, and that is when you really know that you have unconditional permission to eat when you want what you want. Maybe for the first time in your life, you really get to ask, well, do I really want this ice cream now? If I eat this ice cream now, will I enjoy it? And let's say the answer is yes and yes. Maybe for the first time you are tasting the ice cream and you get to ask, do I really like it? And then do I like how it feels in my body? It's a really curious thing. And sometimes with it comes the paradox of, I've had people who've had like love hate relationships with food. They can't, you know, they love, let's say, I don't know, potato chips or Oreo cookies or ice cream, as you were saying, and they don't let themselves have it. They don't let themselves have it. And then it's, it creates what's known as in the research world as a what the hell effect, officially known as restrained eating, where you can't stand it. You believe you're never, ever going to have it again because it's against your rules. And so when you have it, you eat it in a quantity that doesn't feel good. And you say, okay, I need to have more rules again. And so what ends up happening is making peace with food actually ends that kind of war. It ends that kind of rebellion because you get to have it whenever you want. And so there's this ease that happens with your eating that can be really hard to imagine if you've constantly had rules around your own eating.
So for intuitive eating, what are the, I guess you don't even call them rules. What do you call them? Principles?
Yeah, we do call them principles. And you know, it's funny when you write a book, you go in order, but the truth is you can go in any order that you want to. So I'll name them if you want me to, but they won't probably be in order because I don't memorize them. I always use what's important to the individual. So, you know, it's rejecting the diet mentality or rejecting diet culture. And that's acknowledging the harm that that diet culture does. And it, one, a phenomenon I have seen over and over again working with individuals is they have a belief that, well, that diet really worked. There was just something wrong with me that I didn't stay on it. And it's the other way around, that dieting has failed you. And it disrupts this self-connection. It disrupts this trust. And let me also say, you don't have to be perfect coming into this. There can still be a part of you that has a foot in diet culture. And what we ask is when you're working on intuitive eating, is you don't act on that. You know, when diet culture is all around us, it's kind of understandable that you might have a desire to focus on weight. Then there's honoring your hunger, which is so key. There's I think people really underestimate the impact of primal hunger. And that is, let's say you go too long without eating. And when you finally have a chance to eat, it feels like a nonstop food fest. And that's actually an example of your body working. It's no different than if you're going underwater because a big wave comes and you hold your breath, another set comes, so you got to really hold your breath, and you finally come up for air and you're gasping and you inhale that air. And no one says, oh my God, you have loss of control breathing. Oh, you're addicted to air. And we need to look at food that same way, that when we go into extreme cases where you went too long without eating or not enough, there's a compensatory effect that will end up happening, which we call primal hunger.
I was going to ask if we could stay there real quick, because I think that's such an important point. And I think it ties back to the part about coming up for air and sucking down air. And then, you know, because we are all drowning in diet culture. And I think it goes back to this question of why wouldn't we overeat? Because if you have deprived yourself of ice cream for a long time, which is the equivalent of being underwater, and then you come up for air, which is having the freedom to eat what you want and all foods fit, your point is that you might suck a lot of air for a little while, but it doesn't mean you're addicted to air, like you're not addicted to ice cream. Isn't that right?
That's right. That's correct. And then what I'm talking about with honor hunger is the biological drive that ends up happening. We haven't even talked about the psychological impact of when you limit your eating. And so when you've got a biological drive from under eating, and then you don't let yourself to eat a food, it becomes this powerful, powerful force where people will say, there's something wrong with me. And it's like, no, your body is just trying to get your attention. It's saying, dude, please, 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 for the love of God, will you feed me? You know? So those are some things that end up happening. It's really profound. Other principles is rejecting the food police. That has to do with the rules around eating. Like, where did this rule come from? And challenging them both on an internal level and also on a cultural level. And then there's aiming for satisfaction in your eating. And I think I can really say I love every principle, but I really love this one because this is what intuitive eating revolves around. And that is, you know, when you aim for satisfaction, it's so personal, because I don't know what satisfaction feels like for you. And I will often ask people, what does a satisfying meal feel like to you? Or can you remember a really favorite meal? And they'll, you know, describe what that is. And I'll say, oh my God, it sounds amazing and lovely. And now let's do a thought of experiment. We use that same meal. And now you're there with your, and you are in a big fight are you going to have that same level of enjoyment? And the answer is no. And so it puts into context, it's not just the foods that we eat, but it's the environment in which we are eating. And when you're aiming for satisfaction, it's also a way of getting into balance, because ultimately it's not satisfying to undereat, and ultimately it's not satisfying to eat, you know, to a point where you're feeling uncomfortable. Full. And it's such a personal journey to figure out what this is. And I've worked with so many people that don't even know what their favorite meals are, or their favorite foods, because they've been so busy following the rules of some program and some diet that they've lost that sense, you know, with themselves. But it's incredibly, incredibly powerful. Then there's coping with your feelings with kindness. As another principle is respecting your body. And even if you are in the state right now where you hate your body, can you engage in acts of respect toward your body? It's your home. It's your home for the rest of your life. And it's probably one of the most important relationships that you'll have is with yourself. Then we look at, having joy in movement, and then honoring your health with gentle nutrition. I think I went through all 10 principles. And if I didn't, you can tell me.
No, I think you did.
But that's just a nutshell. Yeah.
Start at the top. I mean, there's so much in there. There's a lot to unpack. To start at the top, diet culture. Can we talk about what diet culture is, and what are some of the ways in which it hijacks our thinking around food?
Yeah. So diet culture is this societal cultural belief that you are a better person if you eat a certain way and if you have a certain size body. Yeah, usually it's a smaller body. There's virtue in that. And diet culture is just so insidious. It's everywhere. It's in our institutions, and it impacts and disconnects our relationship with eating, because where diet culture ends up foisting rules onto you that may not be serving you at all, and it becomes really problematic over time.
Yeah. And so I think this is where one of the big issues here for me is, how can we, if we want to go back to trusting our intuition when we eat, how can we intuitively eat when most of us can't hear the sound of our intuition because it's been so drowned in diet culture?
Well, yeah, that's actually a really, really good question. And I'll make it even simpler. Instead of saying listening to our intuition, it's listening to the physical sensations of our bodies. Because most of us can do it, not everybody, and that's okay. We all start at different places. In fact, sidebar, a little detail here, that part of the mechanism of intuitive eating centers around interoceptive awareness. And that's our ability to perceive physical sensations that arise from within the body. Having a full bladder, you know what that state feels like. Having a racing heart rate, most runners know what that feels like. It includes biological cues, but also every emotion has a physical sensation. And so when you're connected with those messages from your body, it is a powerful way that we stay in balance in terms of our meeting our physical needs and psychological needs. It blows me away, this whole process. And there's been a lot of research just on interoceptive awareness and how it really is related to quality of life and other kinds of issues. And so the question is, what parts of the messaging for your body are you already familiar with? And I will often use as, you know, going to the bathroom, peeing, relieving your bladder. That is something in which we have a felt sense. And it'd be a shame if most adults didn't have that capability, but most do. And so there's an awareness that ends up happening, and then we respond in a timely manner. Or maybe another way of looking at it, it's like having text messages from your body. And if we attended to our body the way we attended text messages on our phone, problem solved, you know? So it's hearing that message and then responding in a timely manner in terms of what that might be. So one of the ways I get into this, because this can seem like daunting, is asking the universal attunement question. And it goes like this. How do you feel right now? And you answer one of three ways, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. How do you feel right now? So I'm curious, Clay, if you were to answer that question, how do you feel right now? Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral?
I'd say neutral.
Okay. And there's no wrong or right answer, by the way, to that. And so with that, you're beginning to connect just overall. If you were to say, I feel unpleasant, then the question would be, well, why might that be? What's the need? And notice I'm not asking how hungry you are. I'm not asking what your feelings are. But if it turns out you're feeling unpleasant, then we step back and say, oh, what might I need right now at this moment? Or what might I need, you know, today? And so on. So it's a nice way to even get into all of this stuff of connecting. And so the thing I want to emphasize is even if you're not trusting your body, it's possible to rebuild that trust. Every time you honor hunger with every single bite of food, you are rebuilding that self-trust. It is possible.
So what's interesting to me here is this is what brings it out of food and nutrition for me, which is this is really about awareness. And like you said earlier, interoception. Yeah, yeah. And that almost makes it seem like mindfulness. It's almost like eating meditation through eating in some ways.
Oh, you know, it's an interesting statement. So often mindful eating and intuitive eating gets interchanged as if it's the same thing, and it's not. Mindfulness and mindful eating is a beautiful model. There's similarities, but there's a lot of differences. The similarities is you're honoring your biological cues. There's no judgmental awareness. But what's different is intuitive eating, we actually have a directive that we need to reject the diet culture in order to move forward in this. And so I heard one academic describing it this way, that, you know, intuitive eating is a framework and mindful eating is a specific skill set.
Okay. But to bring it back to awareness of text messages from my body every day after I eat lunch, I want chocolate every day. And I don't know. I mean, I haven't had my physical this year. My blood work's usually good. I'm blessed with good genetics. I eat a ton of candy. Like, I'm talking Sour Patch Kids, ice cream, cookies. And again, I feel like I'm lucky because I have good genetics, but I don't think that can be healthy, or to use a word I know you're not going to like, I don't think that can be good for me. But am I wrong? Like,
Well, what's interesting, I'm not going to give you a direct answer.
No good teacher does.
I'm going to ask some questions to understand what's going on, you know. And so the fact that you said, you know, that you're a runner, that would suggest, I don't know how often you run, but I would imagine, especially on the days that you run, you probably seek more candy. That would be a guess I would have. Is there any truth in that?
I would say that's fair, but I would say I'm so habituated to it that I run most days. So I guess it's hard to tell, but I run at least 5 or 6 days a week. But I would really have to pay attention to the seventh day, but yeah.
Yeah. So I'll tell you something that I see, and this may or may not apply to you, is that, you know, when you are working out consistently like that, we do have a drive to eat, to nourish the body. And if you haven't got enough to eat, let's say you're still eating, you still had breakfast and lunch and whatnot, but if it wasn't enough, what tends to happen is there's a craving towards sweets. And so it's kind of a way for the body to get into getting essential energy, because we need carbohydrates to really fuel us. In fact, another side note, very interesting, the International Olympic Committee just came out with a new position paper just last month on relative energy deficiency syndrome. And what that is when athletes don't get enough to eat. They don't really meet the criteria for eating disorders, but the under eating or the sub eating is enough to affect almost every health system in the body, like the endocrine system, the skeletal health system, and so forth. And it has an impact. And what they also said is that if in conjunction you're eating low carbohydrates, it amplifies the problems. And so I just want to bring that into the conversation, because I have worked with a lot of athletes and people over the years who have this belief that eating carbohydrates is wrong. And so they end up getting these, you know, intense sweet cravings just as a way to honor the body, you know? So my question to you is, you know, you made a statement that you don't think this is possibly good. Why do you think that?
Because I'm steeped in diet culture, but I will say it seems to me that, and I could be wrong, I'm speaking based on things that, this is all secondary information. I have not read the primary sources or the studies, but it seems to me that the carbohydrates provided by, say, a sweet potato or an apple would be, and I'm putting this in quotes, people can't see, but I know you won't like this either, better than the carbohydrates provided by a bag of, you know, Sour Patch Kids.
Okay, so
my intuition would often be like, go have the Sour Patch Kids.
Well, yeah, because here's, and so I don't disagree with what you're saying in terms of nutrient density, but I'll tell you a phenomenon that ends up happening. You have this belief or this rule. I can only eat a little bit of candy to be considered healthy. Maybe let's say one little Sour Patch a day. That's your rule. And maybe you view that as moderate. And I would view that as putting a limitation on your eating. And so what could end up happening is when you feel deprived, when you finally have that Sour Patch candy, if other things are also going on, it could end up leading to eating even more than what you intended and even more what your baseline is right now. And then you get into this problematic kind of eating, this push-pull. So I would say it's all part of balance. We have to recognize the connection we get from eating, and that while there are less nutrients in candy, we still get that carbohydrate value, and there's something to that as well.
Yes. Now, how should we think about determining whether or not, again, just to use myself as the case study here, that impulse after lunch to have chocolate is actually an inability to regulate emotion? Like maybe I'm just bored or maybe I'm stressed. And that is the signal I'm getting. The text message my body's sending is, hey, you're feeling a little stressed, or hey, you're feeling a little anxious. And I'm reading it as, hey, you need a little chocolate. How do we distinguish those text messages?
Okay. Well, it's kind of like what you alluded to earlier, and that's with some awareness, and we get curious, and that is, oh, okay. So I'm in the mood for chocolate right now. I'm curious what's happening. What do I really need right now? What am I feeling? And then kind of take an inventory on that. And it might be that you're not feeling any stress, or it might be that you are. And then you can ask the question, let's say it is stress. Well, what might I need in order to deal with that stress directly? Maybe there's a secondary thing, and that you're putting pressure on yourself. Let's say a timeline. Maybe you need a break after lunch, even though lunch is technically a break, you might need a break. And so sometimes this is subtle. Sometimes that candy or that sweet is actually a way that you give yourself permission to have that little bit of break time before you jump into whatever it is you're going to jump into. And so it's giving yourself permission, like, you know what, I'm giving myself 20 minutes to do absolutely nothing, or absolutely get into games or whatever it happens to be. And then you see, you know, does that make a difference for you?
Mm. But so the overall point here is, if we can get back in touch with our bodies, we would have, and we can understand the messages it's signaling, we would sort of be a self-regulating organism. We wouldn't overeat on the Oreos, and we wouldn't undereat on the, you know, whatever falls into the quote unquote good category. I don't know if it's lean proteins or what, but we would self-regulate if we weren't so disconnected from our body because of all the messages in diet culture.
Yeah, you would get back into balance with your eating and your connection to your body. And that can feel actually really powerful, because what happens over time is, even as the diet culture messages get louder, you get fully grounded in what your own needs are, and it becomes easier to disregard them and actually get disinterested in those messages.
And so someone who is intuitively eating well, what does that look like? What does that feel like? How does it help them in other aspects of their life? What do you hear from your clients?
Oh my gosh, there's so many aspects. I hear lots of really, really cool things. You know, like how it's transformative in terms of changing lives and so on. Because what ends up happening is, when you are connected with what your needs are and you're out of diet culture, you end up getting more brain space in your life to go about the things that you enjoy doing. I can't tell you how many artists that have connected me to say that they got back into their art again, or their creativity has come back. So there's a joy that ends up happening that's really profound. And in terms of the benefits, one of the strongest benefits of intuitive eating, there was just a meta-analysis study on this, is psychological health and well-being, which is really profound. And, you know, we can get into all these conversations about health, but we need to remember that mental health is just as important as physical health. It's the same coin, just a different side of that. And, you know, one thing, you know, from a reflective standpoint, you can ask, you know, how much time do you spend in a day worrying about your eating and your body? And if there's a lot of worry and a lot of anxiety, that's not good for our mental health. And there's ways that we can get through this.
I'd say I spend almost the entire day thinking about food and my body. I'm being completely honest.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I love honesty. Yeah. And, you know, what I would want to know, is it an occupational part of what you do that, you know, if you're getting into fitness and things, you might be thinking about this more. And by the way, there's the normative part about, okay, what I'm going to have for lunch, what I'm going to have for dinner in terms of, you know, kind of planning ahead or having the money to do so. But when it's a source of angst and anxiety, then I would say, ooh, let's take a look at that and see how we can get a little more ease in the eating and a little more ease in the relationship to your body.
And so how do you begin to coach people to do that? If people are listening and they're feeling like, you know, I often, you know, think about, oh, I need to have a salad so that I have to work out so that I can have my sweets later. If people are sort of experiencing these types of diet culture, these types of moralizing food, what are some exercises they can do to begin to, or just some ways of thinking that they can unwind themselves from, untangle their own?
Those are really good examples that you just named. So one of the things I like to do is just name the suffering and look at what is the impact of this, you know? And so one of the things I see a lot is loss of control eating. When someone's following the rules of diet culture, I see a lot of disconnection, not just between self, but between people and their relationships. Like if you're going out for a meal, and your mind is calculating the macros or what you can and can't have and how you're going to compensate, your body is there at the table, but your mind has left the relationship. So that has impacts. And so sometimes it's a recognition that, oh, this is really causing suffering for me. And I want out of that suffering. And then how do we get into this? You know, one of the ways, the ways I like to get people into intuitive eating is to start first with that satisfaction question. What does satisfaction feel like to you? And many times the answer is, I don't know. Well, then let's go on an exploration and see what that might be. You know, looking at the kinds of foods, the quantity of foods, the texture of foods, the taste and all these other kinds of things. And I've had people say that no one's ever asked me that before. No eating plan I've ever been on has ever looked at that before. And so that becomes a way. And recognizing you are the expert of your body, you are the expert of your experience. And intuitive eating is really an inside job. And diet culture is all external, the counting, the measuring, the weighing, all those other kinds of things. And so it's finding ways to let go of that bit by bit.
So what are some better metrics to evaluate our health and our diet, what we eat in terms of not how we eat, but diet in terms of like what's on the menu, not necessarily as a set of governing rules?
Yeah. You know, so I like to look at, you know, how connected was I with my eating experiences and my body for the day, for the most part. And I want to really emphasize, this is not an exercise in perfection. There's no such thing as a perfect intuitive eater. And it's more about learning experiences. A lot of the people I work with, when they're really getting tied into numbers and metrics, one of the things I ask them to do is, can we widen the lens? Instead of just hyper-focusing on this one meal or this one day, let's look at the context of your eating in the week or in 3 days, because then it has a different sense to that. If you are using tracking apps, could you let that go? And sometimes the answer is no, I'm too scared. And so if that's the case, then I would say, can we at least put the focus on how food is feeling in your body, even though you're tracking them with this? And what happens over time is, as you're focusing on those feelings in terms of fullness and satisfaction, you get to develop, it develops more meaning for you. And so then the things that you're counting is of less importance, and then it's easier to let go of those kinds of things.
I think we know some of the obvious ways that we can spot disordered eating, like some of the more, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you know, bulimia, anorexia, you know, like purging and not eating. But I'm curious, what are some of the subtler ways in which we might be eating disordered?
I think it's a really good question, because what's happening is, because of diet culture, is disordered eating behaviors have become really normalized. Like going long periods of time without eating intentionally and completely disregarding the needs of your body. Like you are physically hungry and you're ignoring that. I can't tell you the problems I've seen with people engaged in intermittent fasting, and new emerging research is showing it being linked to eating disorders. So going long periods of time without eating and disregarding what's happening with your body, ignoring or eliminating entire groups of foods. Those are an example. Having rigid rules around your eating. There's nothing wrong with having preferences, but having rigid rules around them, and in which you, it causes great anxiety if you don't adhere to them, can be really, really problematic. Eating in a way that your body is not getting enough, in which you are walking around in this place of kind of this hunger. And then with that comes this fear, like I'm just one bite away from a binge, because your body is hungry. And so it's kind of like you're loading the tension of hunger. And it would be understandable that there's a part of you biologically that just wants to inhale food, you know, from a biological perspective. So those are things I would be looking at. If you can't stop exercising, if you view a movement as something you have to do in order to eat, that's problematic. And I know a lot of people do. It gets fitness programs get sold in that way, but it's really problematic. And you know, one of the things that took me the longest to learn as an athlete is that rest is just as important as the training in of itself. If you're somebody who can't take a day off when you are sick, or if you feel an injury coming on, if you can't modify, those are, you know, problematic signs that I would be looking at. And, you know, if this is resonating with anybody, then, you know, it would be a good idea to, you know, get an evaluation, because these eating disorders are very, very treatable. And yet it's a living hell when you are engaged in it. It's a private hell that people are living through.
Yeah. So is this, so you mentioned that eliminating foods entirely. I often think of, and again, I don't want to make this a therapy session for me, but I'm hoping that my experience will be informative for other people. And
sure.
I imagine other people can relate, but there's something a lot of people talk about when it comes to eating, taking a systems approach, meaning like design mm-hmm. your environment for success. And I try to do this a lot, which is if I have ice cream in my freezer, I'm going to eat it every night. And I have decided that I don't want to eat ice cream every night because to be completely frank, I just feel bad. I moralize it. I'm like, I feel bad that I'm eating ice cream every night. And so the best way I can keep myself, deprive myself, to use some of your language, ice cream, is to just not have it in the house. Because if it's in the house, I'm going to eat it. If I eat it, I'm going to feel guilty. And there's part of me that totally hears all the diet culture in that comment. But there's another part of me that's like, ice cream it's loaded with sugar and it's ultra processed. And that is hard on the internal organs, I believe. So I'm just like trying to navigate this thing in my head. And I'm curious how you would react to that.
I have lots of things, the ways that I'd react to that. First, I want to ask you some questions. Okay, so the way you handle this is by not allowing to have ice cream in the house. So my question is what happens when you finally do get ice cream? Because you like it. What happens when you eat it then?
I eat way too much.
So that's predictable, just so you know. And so you get into, that's a good example of this love-hate push-pull relationship with eating. And, you know, I mentioned earlier the what the hell effect. And what this is, the researchers have described, is really it's restrained eating, in which you have rules around eating. And something happens that breaks that restraint. It could be hunger, it could be an emotion, it could be an event, it could be a circumstance. And when that restraint is broken, then it becomes an all or none thing with the eating. And they've seen this with people with the rigid rules. And so what that ends up doing, it ends up disconnecting you more from your body and creating more anxiety, you know, around the eating. And so I would be looking at, is there a middle way? That's often what I do with my people that I'm working with, is let's find a middle way, you know, with this. So it doesn't feel so, you didn't use this language, but I'm going to. It's as if you're going to be hijacked by ice cream if it's in your freezer. That's the impression I have. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Yes.
Yeah. And so then the question would be, well, maybe you feel okay, you know, living this way, or maybe it's something you'd want to work on. And so if you wanted to work on it, I would go through the process that's scientifically known as habituation, but under our principle of intuitive eating, it's called making peace with food. And what this would be is actually really allowing yourself to have the ice cream and what's really helpful with let me tell you what habituation is. It has to do with novelty, and that is, you know, when something's new, it's really exciting. And the best way I've heard it described is that, you know, when you're falling in love for the first time with somebody and you hear them say, "I love you," it's magical. You are floating. It's amazing. 5 years later, you're in a committed relationship. They say, "I love you," and it's nice, but it's not the same floaty feeling. And think about anything new you've had, a new car, new shoes, new computer, new phone. In the beginning, it's like, okay, great. But we habituate. And it's been shown in all these different areas of life. The challenge is when you have eating rules, you don't habituate to the food. It stays exciting. And then when you finally have it, it becomes scary because you eat in a quantity. Like, oh, I should be eating like that quantity. And then the rules come back again. And so you don't go through this habituation process. And so the habituation process is having permission to eat these foods. I like to do it systematically. So I would have you pick your favorite ice cream and whatever your favorite flavor is, and have that available in the house. And when you decide to eat it in a way that you're giving it its full attention. If it's had that much power over you, then let's be sure when you're eating it, you're really, really enjoying it. And I'll tell you something interesting that happened during COVID, this phenomenon with a lot of patients I was working with virtually. They would say things like, "Oh, you know, I was cleaning out my cupboard because I was bored and I discovered all this candy. I totally forgot about it." And it used to be that that candy would be calling their name. They would definitely not forget about it. And now it's just like it's there and it's time to toss it out. And so these things are possible. That's what I would want you to know. And so that's an aspect. Then, you know, the comment about it being ultra processed, this is such an area that's so interesting because number one, there's no agreed definition on ultra processed foods. Then when there's even a general understanding what those foods are, guess what the biggest category of ultra processed foods are? Guess. Mm-hmm. It's not candy and it's not ice cream.
Meat.
No.
Vegetables.
It is vegetarian products, vegetarian foods are in that category. And when I say that to people, "Oh no, but that's healthy." And so what I would say is it's an example. When we start labeling foods, it becomes, you know, really problematic. And so it just because you would consider it ultra processed doesn't mean it's a food that you can't have to eat. And so I would be looking at what is it that you need and what else is driving the eating drive. Are you getting enough to eat during the day when you're running, which is on most of the days, because that can drive the eating too. If you're not getting enough to eat at the meals, then ice cream or dessert's going to sound extra good when you haven't had enough. And these are things that you get to know with yourself as you start to get more connected. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have noticed that if I eat ice cream 10 days in a row, for instance, there comes a day where I'm like, all right, I don't want it anymore. So I do think that I do self-regulate it at some point. I think one piece of pushback that popped up in my head was you hear a lot that we're evolutionarily wired to overeat, that especially when it comes to calorie dense foods like carbs and sugar, they were hard to come by on the savanna. So over, you know, all these years, we've been programmed to eat past the point of satiation. It's a tough word. And that certain foods like potato chips or Oreos have been sort of engineered to hijack this biological impulse. Do you think, do you respond to that?
It sounds like more fear mongering, you know, because when you start talking about the hypothetical evolutionary times, no one was around there. We have these, you know, little skeletal bits and fossils that you can make up stories and have a narrative around. And the truth is, a long, long time ago, evolutionary wise, you know, I think the average length of living was like 35 years of age. You know, I will say we are wired to survive famine. That is profound. I think that's why we get this profound food drive as well. But, you know, to say that foods are engineered to make you really overeat, it reminds me of, like, you know, if you're having people over for dinner or barbecue or something, you're going to want to make the best kind of meal. You want it to be enjoyable. Chefs in France will do the same thing. I think food companies are also doing the same thing, but I don't really think there's this nefarious thing that they're going to try and get you to eat past, you know, ways that are going to be really, really problematic. And I'm not a spokesperson or a shill for the these food companies, but, you know, as long as we keep fear alive like that, it keeps diet culture alive. Ooh, you better watch out. Ooh, it's going to get you. It seems like there's always a villain in diet culture. There's some soup, there's some food that's really going to mess you up. And then there tends to be some superfood that, okay, eat this and it's going to heal you. And there's no one food that can actually do that, because we need a variety of kinds of foods and so forth. But when you keep the fear alive, then it keeps you doubting yourself and so on. And there's nothing wrong, by the way, with wanting to pursue health, but when it comes at the expense of your mental health, then I have to really question health really being pursued.
That's really interesting.
That's a riddle.
Yeah. I think that's such an interesting insight, though, like how much of this whole wellness industry, the sort of wellness industrial complex, is fueled by fear and insecurity, and how does diet culture feed into that in a way that we are not really even cognizant of, because it's the water we're swimming in.
Exactly that. And you know what's really interesting too, since we're getting into some of the nuances of this, when you start looking at studies that are out there, like the blue zones, and they talk about, you know, people living past 100 if they eat a certain way, but what really gets ignored is there's a big factor of community. And so sometimes food gets all the credit or all the blame, when it turns out there's something else that's going on that actually can explain what is happening. So it's just a fascinating time that we are living in. In fact, sometimes with all of this stuff, and even though I love science, I love nutrition, I have a master of science degree in nutrition, I sometimes really view nutrition as a philosophy, because there's a lot of narratives that go into this. And when you look at the funding, it's really kind of fascinating. We start following the money in that regard.
Yeah. Can you briefly talk about the Minnesota starvation experiment? Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Because I think that's such an interesting case study as well.
Would you like me to describe it? I love
that
please. Study. Yeah, I'll never forget being taught it in grad school. And then recently, I actually got the original. I mean, it's a copy of the original. And I thought it was everything. And it turned out it's two volumes. It's like 2,000 or 4,000 pages. So here's the thing. It's a lesson for all of us, that this was taking place during World War II, when there were food shortages and malnutrition going on. And the researchers at Minnesota said, you know, let's get some volunteers and see what we can do to help alleviate the problem. So they took men who were conscientious objectors and put them on a semi-starvation diet and an exercise program. And even to get into this study, they had to be medically healthy and psychologically in a really good place. So these men were in a really good place. And what ended up happening is it created eating disorder behaviors and thinking. These men became obsessed with food and recipes and collecting cookbooks. And remember, this is the 40s. There were no TV shows with celebrity chefs running around saying bam and all that other kind of stuff. And these men could not stop talking about food. Some of the men, one man went out because he couldn't stand the rules of the diet. He went out and stole candy and binged on it and felt so guilty, he made himself throw up. Similarly, another man went out and binged on milkshakes, felt so guilty, and he threw up as well. So now we have an example of eating disorder behavior. And what's fascinating about this is when you start taking a look at what they were eating in terms of caloric aspect, they were eating between 1,600 and 1,700 calories a day. Granted, it was not enough food for their bodies, and it had this impact. So to me, this is like an example of what modern day food restriction, what the impact is. And it really blew the researchers away. They were expecting all these metabolic things to happen, and they did. You know, their hair fell out, their metabolism slowed down and so forth. But the mental aspect was really profound. And like I said, I've been reading the original study. I'm in the weeds on it. And one of the subjects the psychologist was talking about, the language just got me. I had to read it twice to see if I was reading it right. And the man says, I can't stand the nutrition masturbation, that people keep talking about food and nutrition. And when I read that, I was like, this sounds like he's talking about today and diet culture, you know? And if you think about it, yeah, a person can get really self-absorbed in the diet culture or whatever that they are doing, to the point that they're not even seeing the world around them. So it's a modern day example. Well, it's almost 100 years ago now, but you know, of what food restriction does on the mind.
Yeah. And it goes back to the idea that this sort of, we focus so much on eating to be healthy, but that can cause a stress reaction that's unhealthy. And it's sort of like our obsession with eating healthy creates an unhealthy stress reaction, which cancels out any sort of, again, I'm using quotes, like good nutrition.
Yeah, and to an extreme, there's even a name for that. You know, it's called orthorexia, and it's the paradox of trying to be so healthy, you become unhealthy in the process. And it's not an official, you know, eating disorder diagnosis, but it is recognized by eating disorder professionals as a really big problem. And it has to do with rigidity around, you know, eating to the point that you're eating fewer and fewer foods and with less and less people because you're in situations where the foods that you deem that are okay to eat aren't available. And so isolation's not good for our mental health. We need to be, we are also wired to connect with each other. We're social beings. So there's this fascinating, all of this and how this is all constructed.
May I ask you how did we get, and this is a big question for as we're winding down here, but like, how did we get here? What are some of the key moments in diet culture history, and why is fear so baked into how we eat? Okay.
I have a theory, and it's this. We're going back to World War II again. And during World War II, because of the shortages in the U.S., they formed the U.S. Food and Nutrition Board, which still exists today, that defines the standards for nutrition and nutrients, how much we need. But they had the recognition that if we're going to change our culture's habits as it relates to eating, if we're asking them to, you know, use other kinds of foods because there's a shortage on bread, that's going to take psychology and sociology. So they also had another task group in tandem that was headed by Margaret Mead, the famous, you know, anthropologist. And so it's recognizing the human connection with all of this, the psychology and the sociology. Now, when World War II ended, they kept the U.S. Food and Nutrition Board, but they disbanded Margaret Mead's board. And so what happens then is we're left just with what's also been known as nutritionism. We get so focused just on the nutrients, we do so at disrupting our relationship with our body and our eating. And a lot has been written and said about that. So that's one point in time. And again, it wasn't anything nefarious. It was like, okay, how much nutrients do we need when we have this shortage? But it's totally disregarding the psychology of what is going on. And then I think in modern day too, I think money with big pharma getting involved in all of this, and also capitalism as it relates to weight loss companies and so on. There's never been a product in which fails the consumer and the consumer is blamed. And that creates great, you know, repeat business and so on. So I think those are factors that get into this. And then the fact that, you know, a body that has been thinner has been reified in our culture.
And then what are some ways do you coach people to stay present as they're eating? I think a big problem here to come bring back to awareness is, I mean, this happens to me. I'm always reading something while I eat, or if I'm at dinner, I'm out with a group, and that's great because social connection. I love eating out. I'm lucky to be in New York, and that sort of bonding is wonderful. But I so often am not paying attention to what I'm even eating. And I imagine that's what happens with a lot of people. You hoover up a lunch. You're in the middle of a work day. You get hungry. You go hoover up a lunch and then come back to your desk, and you're not, you know, you might be reading the news, or you're on Instagram, or you're watching TV, or, you know, you're catching up on SNL clips, and you're not really even present. So you don't know what signals your body's sending you because you're not even there. So how do you go to someone to slow down?
That's a really good point. So I'm going to start with something opposite, and that is, I don't want to give the impression that you have to be a monk and light a candle and meditate in order to access intuitive eating, and that you can be at a point where you are eating and doing other things at the same time and still have a sense of what's going on. But what I have seen is that when someone is disconnected to their body and the messages, one of the best ways to reconnect is to eat without distraction. And when I bring that up to new patients who are on the one hand excited about intuitive eating, and then I ask, you know, would you be able to commit to having maybe one meal a day in which you eat without distraction? Oh my God, I get so much pushback. You think I'm asking them to give their firstborn. And what they say to me is, well, what would I do? You know? And my response is, well, besides, you know, I'm not snarky, but we could focus on the sensations of eating and all the senses, you know, related to that. And so I might have them, I love doing guided food experiences in my office, you know, where you pay attention to the senses, how the food looks, how it sounds, how it tastes is obvious. But one of the things I like, because it's nuanced, is to notice the remnant taste or the taste that lingers after you swallow the food. You would take your tongue and roll it around your teeth and just notice that. You get really curious. There's actually things that you can be doing mentally in terms of placing your awareness on the act of eating. But when we've been in the habit of constantly feeling the need to do something while eating, that can actually feel really challenging. And so what I look at is let's find a way to connect. And if taking an entire meal feels like too much of a burden, then all right, how about before you actually commit to eating, how about let's just check in with yourself? What's going on right now with your hunger? What's going on right now in terms of what sounds good to be eating? And just take a note of that. Maybe in the middle of eating, to take a timeout. You know, if you think about it, in professional sports, in football and basketball, there's all kinds of timeouts to check in. Why can't we use the professional athletes as an example of something we can be doing with our eating? And that's just to check in. And looking in the middle of the meal or a snack, you know, how's this food tasting? Am I enjoying it? Is it meeting my expectations? And then when you finish, so that could be just 3 points that you check in, not being, you know, present in the entire meal. That's a way to begin with that. And I like to focus on taste because that's generally not punitive. That's kind of a fun thing to do.
And so if someone wanted to start that, they should try maybe once a week, or how should they begin that practice?
You know what? It depends on what they want to do. If someone is really, really excited and gung-ho, I'd say, well, how about trying it most days? Every day having one meal or one snack in which you just, you know, set a time to pay attention. And the interesting thing is I've had people do this kicking and screaming. And especially when it comes to a meal, what ends up happening over time is it ends up becoming this sacred time and space where now they don't want to be disturbed. They don't want to take a meeting. They don't want to read their emails and so on, because it's become like this sacred time just to kind of relax and connect with the body. The other thing I also want to emphasize is that, you know, your eating doesn't have to be a 10 on satisfaction every time you eat. I've had some people think it has to be like nirvana every time. It's like, no, sometimes it's just, it becomes like Sensible Shoes in New York. You know, you see women running around in sneakers and then holding their nice high heels, you know, as they're going, you know, walking about the city. And so sometimes a meal can just be like Sensible Sneakers. It gets the job done. You got your, you know, energy in and you're on to the next thing. There's nothing wrong with that.
Do you think like saying grace might help? I mean, I'm not a religious person, but I like the idea of like blessing the food and almost using that as a way. The thing I like about grace when I've been around people who do say it is that it allows you to sort of come into your body and into that place and time, and maybe make you a little bit less distracted and more intentional with how you're eating.
I love that idea. And then I would say, you know, if someone isn't into saying grace, is we could certainly set an intention in terms of, enjoying the meal and enjoying the taste that it's offering, and giving gratitude for all the way. In fact, this is actually a Buddhist practice, giving gratitude for the causes and conditions on how the food got to be, to the farmer that grew the food, to the trucker who transported the food, to the person that washed the food, to the grocery store, the clerk that stocked it, and so on. It's interesting when you look at all the different ways that food, you know, got here, that can be an interesting practice in of itself as well. But I love the idea of setting attention, that I am going to pay attention to how this food is tasting and how it feels in my body. Because that's the other thing. When you've been distracted or so into diet culture, often what's happening is you're not paying attention to how the food's actually feeling in your body. You might discover there's foods that you thought you lusted over that, like, oh, I don't like how it feels in my body. I've had patients who will say, okay, I'm gonna have donuts for breakfast. And they come in, they go, would it be okay if I don't eat donuts? And I'm like, why are you asking? It's like, because I don't like how it feels. I don't like how it feels, and I don't want to get back into diet culture. And in that case, they're making a decision based on experience, not based on morality. And I'll say, you can do whatever you want to do, or maybe you like donuts for dessert or something along that line. So you get to pay attention to that. And you don't have to apologize for having a salad either. That's, you know, you don't have to explain. Wouldn't it be great? You sit down to a meal with friends or family and no one explains why they're eating or not eating, whatever that food happens to be, that you actually get to discuss all the juicy details of what's going on in people's lives and in the world and so on. You know,
I also imagine you don't have to finish a meal because you can notice that you're full. I feel like oftentimes people just finish meals because they've always finished meals and don't actually pay attention whether they're full or not.
Yeah, I've seen many versions of that. Sometimes it's a value that they were raised with. In some cultures, there's been famines and food shortages in the family. And so it becomes a really, really strong value. And if that's the case, then I look at, okay, what can we do to honor that value and yet honor what the needs of your body are, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, serving less food or packaging up the food that you didn't eat or putting into a soup or something along that line. There's a lot of ways to work with that.
I've also heard you say you are not your body. And I think that's interesting because I wonder how much of our diet culture is wrapped up in a particular American brand of strengthening of the body and self-development and individualism and this sort of obsession with our bodies versus other cultures, which might prize the idea of interconnectedness, sort of body, a body of people versus individual bodies.
Ooh. I love how you said that. I completely agree with you on that. And so what happens is if you're identifying based on your body, my question is, why is that so important to you, granted the culture that we're living in, but what else might be lacking in your life that you need that particular identity? You know, I often go to Hawaii to go surfing, and I just love the culture. I love the community, and they are very interconnected. It's about the community and helping others as opposed to serving the one, serving yourself and so on. And when I say about the, you know, the identity thing, that's not to throw any shame on somebody who, you know, is into that, because we're living in a culture that reinforces those kinds of things, but it comes at, you know, a really big price. When I'm working with young adults who are about to have families or they're just raising young families, I pose the question, you know, what would it be like to end the legacy of diet culture in your family right here at the kitchen table? And if you reflect on the suffering you've experienced and the idea that, oh, I can have an impact on my kids' life, the idea of changing big culture is really daunting. But the fact that we can look at just our, in our own little spheres in terms of moving the needle and making the difference, I think that's really profound.
Yeah, I love that. Are there any other strategies or tips or tools that come to mind as something that might be helpful to people as they are in their try to extract themselves from diet culture?
Oh my gosh. You know, sometimes this is a really simple one, and it's, I have lots of strategies, but it just depends on where someone is at. Sometimes what I do as a first step is just noticing diet culture in your everyday life. It's kind of like the I spy game. You know, I spy with my little eye, something red, red scarf, red hat, but in this case, diet culture. It could be in the math problems that your kid came home with. It could be in your religious institution, at the pulpit, all kinds of places. Hearing it in the conversation of your friends or discovering that's how some of your friendships are based. That's an eye-opening experience. That can be a first step if you're kind of in this place of ambivalence where, you know, intuitive eating sounds kind of good and also sounds kind of scary. Well, let's step back and just look at where is this in your life? That's first step. And the second step is, how is this impacting you? You know, does it feel good to have that in your life?
Yeah, I think that's an important exercise. Even if people don't want to intuitively eat, just noticing how diet culture has saturated all of our lives is probably a useful exercise.
I agree. Yeah, for sure.
Well, this is wonderful. I appreciate it. So much good stuff in there. It was. Yeah, I feel like I have a lot. Now I got to go eat dinner, and I feel like I have a lot of ideas and strategies about how to do that.
Good. Yeah, I didn't mean to blow your mind, but yeah.
No, it's great. It's great.
I hope it was helpful.
It was super helpful.
Enjoy the
Thank
conversation.
You so much.
Thank you to Dr. Evelyn Triboli for coming on and joining me and talking me through intuitive eating. I think the most broad takeaway that stands out to me is just how out of touch we can get with our bodies. I recorded this podcast before I went on a 10-day silent retreat, but one of the things I learned on that retreat was, and I hope you guys get used to this because obviously, just like running a marathon, if you go on a 10-day silent retreat and you don't talk about it, it's like it never happens. But one of the things I realized was that there's just so many things happening, so many sensations happening that I was completely unaware of until I actually stopped and started paying attention. It's sort of that interoceptive awareness that Dr. Triboli talked about, the understanding of what's happening in your body and the sensations in your body. And what I most enjoyed about this conversation was just the way it made me think about reconnecting with my hunger and my body and giving it what it wants and also what it needs, and how sometimes those two things are actually the same. I've talked about this on this podcast before, but in the past, I was often, when I would do big training blocks for marathons, or right now I'm training for an ultra, I would be undernourished because I just wouldn't get enough calories because I'd been so, again, steeped in diet culture that I was like, I need to cut down on calories and sugar. And actually my body was craving calories and sugar. And so there is a wisdom in the body that I think we can get very disconnected from in society in many facets, but certainly when it comes to diet and eating. And so if I'm taking one thing from intuitive eating, it's just reconnecting literally with my body's intuition and trying to listen to what it wants, what it needs, when it wants it. And then also being present enough for the meals that I know when it has had enough and I'm not eating past the point of satiation. Thank you again to Dr. Evelyn Triboli. Thank you to you for listening. Thank you to the rest of the Growth Equation team, Brad Stahlberg, Steve Magnus, Chris Douglas, Nate Meckler, and John Summerford. We'll be back on Monday. Looking forward to seeing you then. Have a great weekend. And as always, farewell.